It's 7 minutes past 10. I'm Kara Lawrence. Today we'll be talking about this Saturday's concert by the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra. As the season continues, we've been looking at different conductors throughout. There are a number of candidates in the running for the next music director of the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra, and one of those candidates is with me here today. Andrew Grams, nice to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
And we also, as a particular bonus, have the soloist in Saturday night's concert, Pablo Fernandez Castro. Nice to have you here as well.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us all the way from Berlin.
Yeah, thank you.
For this concert. And Andrew, you hail from a bit closer.
All the way from Cleveland.
Incredibly a difficult journey, I'm sure. But let's hear a little about your experience. I understand as a young conductor, you were assistant conductor at Cleveland under Franz Welser-Mürst,
mm-hmm.
and also have had the opportunity to conduct many orchestras around the country as well as beyond,
mm-hmm.
and currently are a music director of your own symphony in Elgin.
Yes, the Elgin Symphony Orchestra outside of Chicago. A number of my Elgin musicians also play here in Kalamazoo, and so I've heard a lot of wonderful things about this organization over the course of these past, you know, 4 or 5 seasons.
Well, they're musicians, Elgin, so good and bad, I'm sure.
No, actually, they've never told me bad things. Actually, no, I shouldn't say that. They've told me less than stellar things, but it had more to do with the size of the big venue than anything else.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
You know, when we talk about symphony experiences, we always think of, you know, the musicians on the stage and the conductor and the music that we're playing. But what we usually don't wind up talking about, which I think we should, is how the role that the actual hall itself plays in the experience of that music. And when you have a hall that is over 3,000 seats, that's going to affect how the music is perceived by the public.
Right.
And, you know, these are things that we don't really start to think about until later in life. A lot of listeners will probably, they would recognize the great Musikverein in Vienna if they ever watch the New Year's Day concert with the Vienna Philharmonic every year. And the hall on television looks huge. But it really only is about 1,400, 1,500 seats. And that, you know, is something that size makes the music very, very overwhelming.
And it affords pretty much everyone in the hall a concert experience that is quite vivid.
Yes.
And,
you feel very close to the music.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's almost another character in the story of a symphony concert.
It very, very much is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this concert happens to be taking place in our version of the Musikverein, and that's
yes.
Chenery Auditorium downtown on West Nedge Avenue. And the concert begins at 8 o'clock Saturday night. Will you be giving a pre-concert
yes.
informative lecture?
Yeah, Daniel and I will have a nice, lively half-hour discussion. Of the repertoire, probably of conductors, you know, also Q&As. I really like to have back and forth discussions with the public. I don't know if you can tell, but I like to talk.
I haven't learned that yet, but hopefully by the end of this hour, we will have an even better sense of that. You began your musical life playing violin?
Yes.
Yes. Tell me about the deep dive into music for you.
Third grade, 8 years old, had very, very good music classes in the public school system outside of Baltimore, which is where I grew up. And I don't really remember why I got into it. My mom's theory is that I saw some of my fellow classmates getting to leave math class to go do strings. And so I probably was like, I want to get in on that.
Brutally honest.
that's her theory.
Oh.
But after taking up the violin and doing that for however long, I developed the desire to be a musician when I grew up. Now, I didn't know what that really meant. And it wasn't, I didn't have, a desire to be, like an Itzhak Perlman soloist. I didn't have a desire to play in an orchestra, but I knew that I wanted to be a musician from a very early age, probably 9 or even 10. And it was shocking to me all through high school and even through my years at Juilliard that so many of my friends and peers had no idea what they wanted to do with their lives. I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a musician. Again, much to my mother's consternation. You know, no mother is like, oh boy, I really want my kid to be a starving artist. But she and my entire family was always very supportive. And they just, as she says, I just rode Andrew's coattails because he had us driving him to this, to that, to this, to that, to do. And, wound up going to a performing arts high school, went to Juilliard, won a position in the New York City Ballet Orchestra, which led to my being able to play in a lot of other orchestras in and around the New York City area. It was there that after playing for however, probably a year and a half of working, I was young and idealistic and punkish enough to think that I could do better than some of the conductors I was playing for.
Well, you kind of have to.
Yeah.
I think so. Get into it, yeah.
And so I wound up going back to school, and then that led one thing to another, Cleveland, guest conducting, music directorship, and now here this week in Kalamazoo.
Did you get to see live performances a lot when you were young?
Actually, yes. I actually do remember my first field trip down to see the Baltimore Symphony. My parents also took me to about 3 or 4 Saturday morning casual concerts of the Baltimore Symphony, where out of that week's program, they would usually perform 1 or 2 of the pieces. And, people could come in jeans. That was the whole idea behind this particular series that Baltimore Symphony used to do. In high school, I was a member of the National Symphony Orchestra Youth Fellowship Program down at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. And so I got to see Rostropovich actually before he left there. I was always able to go to see a lot of live performances of great artists and great orchestras, and I was a very, very, very fortunate youth.
The program that is set for Saturday is 3 genius composers that would actually give me pause if I was the guest conductor. I mean, it starts with Mozart. Great. I can handle Mozart. Mm. Haydn. Wow. Okay. Next Viennese guy. And then Beethoven. Mozart, Haydn, and Beethoven. And you are forced to contend, let's say, with the some of the most heard classical artists ever. Mm-hmm. And it's now up to you, without the luxury of a lesser-known piece that you can sort of bring your own particular mm-hmm. taste to, you really need to stand out with these 3 great composers who we all know so very, very well. That just sounds like a big challenge to me.
If you put it that way, I guess it would be a big challenge. I guess I'm lucky in that I don't necessarily see that as a challenge. As I don't see those musical giants as the insurmountable edifices that they can sometimes appear to be. My job is to get the musicians to play those pieces as well as possible. And so, when I'm working, when we are rehearsing together, when we are making music together, I'm not thinking about how great any one of these pieces is as we're working on it. I am thinking about how how can this, which is already sounding very good, sound even better? So I'm listening critically to what the musicians are offering as individuals or as a group through these pieces of music, and then I am trying to find ways to clarify it, bump it up, make it more dramatic. How can we give a very exciting, dramatic, interesting, vivid, vibrant, overwhelming performance of these pieces that are also extremely well known to them? And so one of the advantages of a program like this is that the musicians already know this music very, very well. And so we can, in rehearsal, we can get to the nitty-gritty much quicker than if we were performing a piece that is less familiar, that we need to just, okay, let's get it together, blah, 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 blah. Now we can really, you know, since everybody knows it very well, we can just, okay, bump that up, bump that down, do this, do that, and things come together much quicker.
Your career timeline comes in parallel with an excitement, a great deal of energy around historically informed performance. Mm-hmm. Great mm-hmm. conductors, great ensembles coming up in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond. So I just wanted to get your take on what kind of, when you take a modern orchestra to play, say, this Mozart overture to the Magic Flute, mm-hmm. What kind of sound are you looking for?
Well, not necessarily a period practice sound, which tends to, well, what I love about these period ensembles is, has a little less to do with their sound. No, I shouldn't say that, because it is, okay, it has less to do with the fact that they're playing on period instruments using period reeds or period bows that sound very different from today's modern instruments, but that they do function as incredibly high achieving ensembles, groups of people that work together in an incredibly fine, elegant, and unanimous way of playing. And when you approach with a modern group, you know, pieces like these that can be performed in that style, one thing that I'm always trying to achieve is that unanimity of ensemble performance, but utilizing the strengths and minimizing the weaknesses of the modern instrument. Mm. So, for instance, with the Mozart overture, to me, the bulk of this overture, which goes by lickety-split, needs a lot of clarity. It needs a lot of articulation. Each small note needs to pop in a certain light way. Getting everybody to do that with the modern instrument is relatively easy, but it just means that everybody on the stage needs to approach the production of sound in exactly the same way. Mm-hmm. And so what we've been rehearsing is getting everybody in the same part of the bow, using the same bow stroke off the string to get a certain shortness, getting two forte eighth notes rather than just one. You know, these very, very small things that add up to make a very, very interesting and exciting rendition. One of the great things that about living in today's age, in that we've got a bajillion recordings of this overture available to us on Spotify, period performances like the one that we're going to hear today. There's a great old performances, old style performances,
yeah.
And you can hear the gamut, and each one can be very, very exciting in its own way.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the quest for all of us is just playing this stuff in the most interesting, exciting, dramatic way that we possibly can.
With a full orchestra on Saturday night at 8 o'clock, the music begins. Details for the program and information on tickets is at KalamazooSymphony.org or KalamazooSymphony.com, either one. Well, it's time to hear the Mozart Magic Flute Overture, and I picked out a recording of the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields. Sir Neville Mariner is the conductor. The Overture to the Magic Flute by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. And if you just tuned in during the music, I want to introduce you to guest conductor Andrew Grams, who is visiting us this week to conduct the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra on Saturday. The program starts with this overture. And also in the studio, we have the guest soloist, cellist Pablo Fernandez Castro, who is visiting us all the way from Berlin today and will be performing Haydn's Cello Concerto No. 1 in C major on Saturday night. Details at KalamazooSymphony.com. And I didn't think Sir Neville did a bad job there at all. That was very exciting.
Of course, the musicians of the Academy. Well, actually, when I was growing up outside of Baltimore, we had three full-time radio stations, and the vast majority of the recordings were Sir Neville Mariner and the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields.
Or Herbert von Karajan, who was also laying down record after record in that era. Well, Pablo, it's time to put you in the hot seat, and I'd like to kind of get the outline of your musical journey, your career. May I ask about your beginnings as a cellist, please?
Well, it's both my parents are musicians. No, my father's a cellist, and my mom used to play guitar, so it was very natural to me. They just gave me a tiny cello, when I was three. And I don't even remember. So my first memory is already playing cello, and I never questioned it. I liked it. I think I played it okay, and then I just kept going.
Where was this? What is your country of birth?
I'm from Spain. I'm from Madrid. Yeah.
All right. And were they both classical musicians, or did they also enjoy other kinds of music? Your parents, yeah.
Oh, well, they're both classical. Well, my mom started as a flamenco guitar. It's kind of a cliche being Spanish. She actually was great. She was one of the very few women who play guitar, because in the flamenco world it's a bit sexist. So for a woman to play guitar is not so common.
Right. And there are traditional roles.
The gypsies are very, very particular with this. And she actually she was the first woman to win a prize in a competition of guitar, in a flamenco guitar competition. And she couldn't take the prize. She had to run away because all the gypsies, that was back in the time, but all the gypsies were so mad that a woman took the place of a man. So she was so disappointed after that, and she quit guitar. But she was great. I mean, she performed with Paco de Lucía in Carnegie Hall in New York. She played in Finland. She played all over the place. But after that, she went to the conservatory to do classical music. And that's where she met my father. And yeah, that's it.
And they started a family.
Yeah.
Do you have siblings?
Yeah, I have a younger sister, Sara. She plays the viola, and she lives in Berlin also.
What brought you to Berlin? Was it school or?
No, I think it's just a very fun city full of music, and I have so many friends there, and my sister also lived there. And since I'm traveling so much, I didn't really care where to live. So For the 3-4 days that I'm at home, I'd rather be with my friends and with my sister than just alone somewhere else.
Did you launch your career as a solo cellist after competing in a music competition?
Yeah, actually, well, yeah, I would say that after Tchaikovsky competition, my career really went like abruptly, suddenly super fast. I went from like 30 concerts to like almost 70 this season, and so it keeps me very busy. And in that way, it really helped. Yeah,
that's a lot of concerts to prepare for.
Yeah, it's sometimes it's a bit overwhelming, but it's a nice challenge.
Yeah. Well, how long have the two Haydn concertos been in your repertoire?
Oh, since long ago, yeah. Especially the C major. I played it really often, but it's one of my very favorite pieces. I think it's so positive and wonderful. Every time I play it, I feel just happy and energetic. And I think it's a great piece also for the audience. No, I think it's a perfect concerto, actually. How the form of it, the shape, and the second movement is beautiful. The first movement is also incredible. And the third movement is super virtuosic. People love it.
I guess I would ask you something similar to what I talked to Andrew Grahams about, and that is, do you have a set interpretation of this piece, or do you like to grab influences from other recordings or performances, or even just feeling different on a different night?
Well, I think since I played so often and with so many different people, I think it does change every time I play it, in a way, no? Because also I like to think and feel that this is kind of like an improvisation with colleagues when you play with friends. And yeah, I mean, every time, every orchestra is different, every conductor is different, and I like to grab the influence that they give me and do something with it.
That's a kind of freedom that you get with a certain mastery, I think, of your instrument that allows you to play a little more or
definitely
have fun.
It makes it more fun. Yeah, as you say, like when you play this for 100th time, if you play it always the same and you go with the same intention, it might get a bit boring. But like this, it's always new and fresh.
What are some of your other interests besides being a solo cellist and playing concertos with orchestras in their seasons? Do you have interests in chamber music or recital?
Yeah, I mean, of course, I love to play chamber music. Unfortunately, it's not what I do most. Well, I mean, probably 95% of my concerts are with orchestra, so at the moment, so that's what I'm doing the most. And it's also probably what I like the most at this time. But in the summers, when the orchestra season is over, I do a lot of festivals with chamber music, and that's like a holiday. That's awesome when you get to rehearse with friends and musicians that you admire, and you really learn so much from that.
Mm. What other music besides classical music do you like?
I'm in love with blues lately, like crazy. Like B.B. King, I'm obsessed with him. Like right before coming, I was just watching this video from a live performance he did in Montreux. And my God, he's just a genius. I actually, in the last couple, 2-3 months, I've been watching videos of him right before going on stage, because I feel like the power of communication that he has is something I want to achieve. No, like I see him in front of like 10,000 people, and he seems so in the moment. And I picture that when I play sometimes. Yeah.
And playing his instrument, singing together, the whole thing is communicating, all
his,
at once.
His magic, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and his connection to the rhythm.
Yeah. Also, what I like is that he doesn't need to play many notes. He plays like 3 notes, and the 3 notes they speak like a whole sentence. This craziness. Some other musicians, they need to play like 1,000 notes to make it interesting. He plays 2 notes, like pam pam, and this, you're like, wow, he just music communication, right? Boom, the message gets directly out. It's incredible.
How does he do that?
Yeah. I don't know.
My guest is Pablo Fernandez Castro, who is the cello soloist in Saturday night's concert in Chenery Auditorium with Haydn's Concerto No. 1. And we're going to take a break now and listen to, I think, the first movement. Would that be?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
We'll see how this concerto begins, and then we can hear the rest of the story after we listen to this recording. And what do we have here? We have Stephen Isserles and the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, led by Sir Roger Norrington. That's the first movement of Haydn's Cello Concerto No. 1 in C major, and you'll have to be in your seat at Chenery Auditorium on Saturday to hear the full performance live with cellist Pablo Fernandez Castro. And in that recording, we heard the soloist play his own cadenza. And so during the music, I asked Pablo, what cadenza, whose cadenza are you playing? And you said you're playing your own as well.
Yeah, I like to make my own cadenzas. I think it's a challenge, you know, because it makes you like think what does the music tell you, and also I like to go a bit far away from Haydn when I do my cadenzas, still being in, you know, in the same language, of course, but I like to make a couple jokes here and there, because Haydn was famous for having a great sense of humor, so I like to put a little bit of that as well. So yeah, I hope the people like it.
Any flamenco?
No flamenco, no.
Any B.B. King.
Oh, maybe next one, actually. I should put that in, yeah.
So just for those who might not remember the definition of cadenza, it's a point in a movement of a concerto where the soloist or the orchestra stops and the soloist is allowed to the freedom of playing what they want to play, but almost always it references what has come before.
It has to be about what you just played, of course. You cannot start to play like Borsa Concerto. a Bach suite there. Yeah.
How do you go about composing a cadenza? Do you actually write it down?
No, I didn't write it down. None of them. I changed it up a few times, and like my example, the Haydn D major cadenza, I played it. I don't play Haydn D since a long time, so I will have to rewatch the video to remember my own cadenza, or to just make another one.
Just make another one. Yeah. Well, how do you know when it's over?
Well, I mean, you have to. You cannot be like 30 minutes cadenza, of course.
the conductor starts to tap his foot.
Mine is 47 waiting. Minutes long.
The orchestra gets up and goes to the bar.
And I just take it from here, guys. Just come in like 30 minutes. No. It's like 2 minutes, something like this. Just a little comment.
Andrew, do you like good surprises during a concert?
Oh, yes. Actually, there was one time I was performing one of the Mozart horn concertos, and the father of the soloist was in the audience, and it was his birthday, and she brilliantly worked her way from making, you know, the beginning of the cadenza, which was commenting on the material from the concerto.
It
she worked her
like
way
Mozart.
Then into Happy Birthday and then out so that when the orchestra could come back in. But it was absolutely hilarious.
It's anything brilliant. Could happen Saturday night. The concert begins at 8 o'clock. There is a 7 o'clock pre-music talk with Andrew Grams, who is my guest here today, along with Pablo Ferrandez-Castro. And the concert information is online at kalamazoosymphony.org. Mozart, Haydn, and Beethoven is the program, and that's where we're standing right now. Just a little chat about Beethoven's 7th symphony. I'm assuming that this music has been in your ears for years and years and years. Is the opportunity to conduct it, does that come along very often?
It's for me, it has. This particular symphony I've done quite a few times. I the last time that I did it was this past fall, actually, in Elgin. And I was talking with some of the players here at the rehearsal last night. I was like, we did this together, and where were you off that concert? He said, no, I was there for that. Okay, good. I've played it many times in the orchestra as a violinist, and I've conducted it quite a few times, but it is perhaps one of the earliest symphonies from my childhood that I can possibly remember. So it feels like Beethoven 7 is, you know, part of who I am as a person. And my appreciation for it has only grown over the years. But I will say that I think that my approach to the symphony has also changed over the years. I don't think that I go for as wild and unbridled a performance as I used to. I look for something a little bit more controlled so that the impact does not come from just scattered wild energy, mm-hmm. but actual controlled force. So hopefully that's what we'll come up with for Saturday night.
That's interesting that, you know, your idea of of peak Beethoven is allowed to modify itself over time, and that the same composer can be looked at from all these angles.
Yes, yeah. Well, and I think that just about any composer, music does not exist until a performer brings it into existence, and that performer is it's impossible for that performer not to put some part of themselves into or onto the music that they're trying to bring into existence. So, one would have to assume that as time goes on, your way of playing it evolves as you evolve.
We are near the end of our time here today, and I wish I could keep you longer. It's fascinating to hear your thoughts on this program and how you mentally prepare for that. And I would like to have you maybe share some of your thoughts on what this position might mean for Kalamazoo. If you're able to become the music director, and like what some of the thoughts you might have on moving forward in this position?
Well, the music director position is actually not so much about conducting. Everybody always thinks, well, you're the conductor of the orchestra, right? Yes. But as I have learned over the past number of years, actually being a music director, I would say that the conducting or musical aspect of the music director's role is maybe 5 or 10% of what your actual time and attention is spent doing. What I think the music director's role is to be an ambassador and a cheerleader for the orchestra, for this music that we perform. And I don't really like to call it classical music, because I think that's a very, very limiting term. And it's also a term that, you know, ever since my days as a youth growing up, was actually kind of a pejorative term. I like to talk about serious music or symphonic music. And the music director's role is to be a champion for the music and its relationship to the community that it is serving. And with that in mind, you know, a music director gets to know a lot of people, not just the musicians and the staff of the orchestra, but local community leaders, government officials,
radio announcers,
very important radio announcers with wicked tea making skills. the music director's role really is. One of the things that you'll get to know about me is that I tend to find an idea and then wander off somewhere else. But this really is relevant. Some years ago, I was either watching or listening to Yo-Yo Ma talk about his life and his career. And he said something that really stuck with me that I then, you know, sort of took and has become, I think, part of who I am as a person, but really more of who I am as a music director. And Yo-Yo was saying that he used to think that the most interesting thing to him was music and all the different styles of music from around the world and this, that, and the other. But what he soon discovered was what he was really interested in was people. And the different musics were a way for him to learn about people. And I take that and use that now, because I would have to agree with Yo-Yo that I have found, you know, when I was in school and I was, you know, much younger, the music was the most important thing. But being a conductor for these years now and being a music director, I'm not working as a conductor with the music. I'm working with people that are making the music. And that, I think, is really, it is much, much more about people coming together, making sound, audience coming to commune with these people making sound in a space mm-hmm. together. That's the really, really interesting bit.
And that's where the life is lived.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you have to have life in order for it to live.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, the community. And well, before I weaken what you just said, I'll just say thank you, Andrew Grahams, for coming to Kalamazoo.
Thank you for having
me. Have a wonderful concert on Saturday.
Oh, we will. It'll be fun.
Pablo, thank you also for coming along.
Thank you.
And sharing your thoughts on the concerto. And I hope we hear something completely new on Saturday with that. We have just a few seconds left in the hour, and that means just a few seconds of Beethoven. Thank you once again. The concert is Saturday at 8 o'clock with a pre-concert talk at 7 p.m. Please join them. The information is at KalamazooSymphony.com.